It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Fred Katz is in the building. Fred and I, we're going to dive deep into a lot of Atlantic Division things, probably a little bit more than other things, but we'll get into some NBA news and notes a little bit later on. We do want to mention the Karl Towns injury. He'll be out for seemingly a little bit over a month. And then we're going to maybe talk a little bit about some potential trade things that haven't happened yet, like such as Jay Crowder, maybe if we have time, it depends. But the middle bulk portion of this episode is going to be talking about the Knicks. What are the Knicks? What do Knicks do here, would you say? I have a lot of questions on what their overall direction is right now based off of this season and based off of some of the things we've seen. Not all bad, but just generally, I'm not sure of the direction. And then we're going to start with the Boston Celtics, with Al Horford's extension, with Jason Tatum's dominance, with some long-term planning, and just kind of dive in. Fred, what's going on, buddy? It's been a few months since you've been on the show, unfortunately.
It's been a bit. You know, I have to say, Sam, they say that divisions don't matter in the NBA anymore. But you know what? Don't tell that to the Game Theory Podcast. Because whenever I come on here, we're talking Atlantic Division. You're the only reference that I ever hear to any division in the NBA other than the one division title that the Raptors won during the Vince Carter era. That the only time I ever hear to the only reference I ever hear to divisions in the NBA is when I listen to this podcast or I'm on this podcast and I hear, today we are talking about the Southeast.
That's right.
He says enthusiasm as you do.
You gotta find a way to break things up into little manageable chunks, right? And the NBA does it for us. They do it for us with divisions. It's not even like it's somewhat applicable to scheduling, I guess. That's really the only way it matters.
It's so incredibly irrelevant, Sam, that I watch a truly unhealthy amount of NBA basketball and spend so much time just like looking at numbers and Jericho Sims pick and roll tape. And if you said off the top of your head, name the NBA divisions in any order you want, I will forget at least two of them. I would just not be able to recall at least two of them.
That's a good trivia time. Let's see if I can do it. Just like from having talked about them on this show for multiple years longer.
Right, well, you're the division master. You know how like everyone in NBA media marvels over Jamal Crawford's ability to name his 16 NBA head coaches off the top of his head in like 16 seconds. That will be your thing, but with divisions.
So it's Atlantic, Central, Southeast, Northwest, Pacific, Southwest.
Southwest, because I know the Portland Trailblazers are in the Southwest.
That's right. There we go. We got it.
Oh, no.
I still got it, baby.
No, they're not. I don't even know. Yeah. The Oklahoma City Thunder are in the Northwest. That's what it is.
That's right. Yeah, it's a bizarre deal. Okay. We want to try and get you out of here.
That affected my life when I was covering the Thunder, and I had to travel twice a year to Portland or wherever else. And I was like, this doesn't make. I get that they used to be in Seattle, but it's been a decade, man. Let's make this flip.
Okay, so we want to get Fred out of here in a reasonable amount of time, because half the time Fred ends up on this podcast for like an hour and a half, because he and I tend to go on like bullshit tangents way too often.
I can't imagine why. You mean like that?
So, okay, let's jump into what we want to talk about. The first thing I just want to note off the top, Al Horford gets a 2-year, $20 million extension from the Boston Celtics. It's a fascinating deal. Al Horford's been awesome this year. There are like some cracks starting to show a little bit here and there, but he started 18 of their games so far, averaging like 10 points a game, 6 or 7 rebounds, shooting 55% from the field, 48% from three on reasonable volume, doing just everything that you hope to see from Al Horford. He's averaging like 3 assists per game. It's just who he is. He's the consummate professional NBA center, and he's the perfect center for the modern game. I do think that we're starting to see just like a little bit of the cracks defensively here and there from time to time, where they struggle to contain just a little bit more when he's involved in the action. And he's not like a great rim protector anymore by any stretch of the imagination. But the value he adds offensively in terms of intelligence, ball movement, shooting, skill, finishing ability, intelligence in terms of shot selection, this is a great contract for them right now. It's basically a no-risk contract for them at 2 years, $20 million, right?
I mean, there's less money guaranteed than the projected mid-level exception. Like, yeah. It's quite little. So my reaction when I first saw it was like, man, they got Al Horford for that short. And by the way, basically every extension that Boston has given out under Brad Stevens, seems like extensions are kind of his thing. It's kind of building a little bit of an identity as an executive now. And he's got the Marcus Smart extension. He's got the Robert Williams extension. He's got the Josh Richardson extension. And now he's got the Horford one. And every extension has worked out. Even the Josh Richardson one where they tacked out an extra year, it's like they just flipped him for Derek White, who, by the way, is another Celtic who was essential in taking him to the finals last year and has been unbelievable this year. Extension sign, I'm like, well, that just worked out wonderfully. And with the Horford one I looked at, I'm like, man, they got Horford for – that just seems too cheap. It just seems too cheap for Al Horford. And then I was talking to somebody in the league who's uninvolved with the Celtics and uninvolved with Horford, but just another person in the league. And I said that to him. I was like, this is just way too cheap for Al Horford. This is insane. And that person kind of said to me, like, not really. Al Horford is 36 years old. Yeah. And at some point when you're 36, his entire reputation is that, like you just said, he's the consummate professional. He just had a streak snapped in which he had the most amount of games his professional. He played the most amount of games of any player in the NBA without actually making it to the NBA finals. And that obviously just snapped in the spring. And he did the Philly thing. It didn't work. He did the OKC thing, actually played pretty well in OKC, but, you know, ended up getting sent home because it was a bad basketball situation because they were trying to lose. And he ends up finding his way back to Boston and recovers his career. And it's like, when you think about it like that, where it's like, he's 36 years old. He has a chance to legitimately win a title, as good of a chance as any other team could give him in the league. And he is in the place that has given him now twice an incredible basketball fit, an incredible basketball situation. Where else would he want to finish the last few good years he has remaining? Yeah. And by the way, I realize that you were very complimentary of Al Horford's game just now. I actually think there's an argument to be made that you were too harsh. I am curious to see if you're going to be saying if Horford's defensive game has fallen off a tick once Robert Williams comes back. Because when he and Robert Williams play together, changes the way that he can defend, that covers up just about everybody's warts. And certainly if you think a guy is just like an eighth of a step slower, he's not going to look an eighth of a step slower when you've got Robert Williams coming over and helping from the weak side. And Horford is so unbelievably smart. I mean, he is as smart of a defender as you can come by. He's unbelievably smart. He's such a great positional defender that when he knows he has that weapon on the weak side, he defends basically flawlessly. And that was part of the reason why their defense was just, you could score against them in the second half of last year when they went on that run and into the finals. So I don't even know if he's going to look like a different defender. It could just be that Rob Williams has been out. And when you have Rob Williams back, he's going to look exactly the same as he did last year.
I think you're right, to be honest. And here's the other thing with this contract. It doesn't preclude them from doing anything long term, right? Like, the big thing, the big decision that's coming for them is whether or not Jaylen Brown makes All-NBA this season and thus becomes Supermax extension eligible and, like, potentially an option to sign an extension or not. Because Jaylen Brown, because the contract he signed off of his rookie deal was so cheap, he can only make, if he doesn't make All-NBA, 120% of what his current number is, which is in the, like, 25, 26 ballpark, if I remember correctly. And he'd be taking a bath on an extension if he signed an extension. So that's the big thing that's coming for them at the end of the day. But another decision that's coming for them is Grant Williams, right? Like, they're going to have to figure out what to do with Grant. Grant's been awesome to start the year, and he decided to bet on himself and not sign an extension for relatively cheap, as opposed to what I think he's going to be worth on the open market this summer in a down free agency class, in a situation where he really could end up getting real dollars and cents attached to his name. So keeping Al Horford at this number allows them to stay in the Grant Williams sweepstakes, allows them no real issues in terms of flexibility long term. This is a home run. And, like, just Al Horford in general, man, like, if they win a title and he is, like, a starting power forward slash center on this title team, I don't think we're going to get to the point where Hall of Fame is a discussion with him, but maybe we don't get to a point where he makes the Hall of Fame.
You never know. It is a discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't forget, like, in basketball, they care about college stuff, and he won two NCAA titles. Like, Grant Hill is getting in there, and people justify him with Duke, right? Like, it's like he was on, like, iconic collegiate teams and won back-to-back titles, and that's something that would definitely be part of his resume. Also, like, let's be real, nobody really understands how the voting works for the Hall of Fame, and everybody likes Al Horford. Like, have you ever heard a bad word about Al Horford? So, like, benefit of the doubt, don't count against somebody just getting the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, you know? I think that's dead on. Like, he really could get the benefit of the doubt here. Look, we'll see where the Celtics season ends, but it's on a real positive trajectory right now because Jason Tatum looks like this is the best offense I maybe have seen in the NBA, like, point blank. I know that the numbers say it's the best offense of all time right now, but just aesthetically, it's beautiful. And it's because of, like, Jason Tatum at the center of it. He is such a remarkable three-level scorer. And in today's NBA, if you have to guard multiple players from all three levels, like teams do with Jason and Jaylen Brown, it really just opens up the defense to such a substantial extent. It's so, so hard to guard them. They can go super fast and small. They can go, once Rob Williams gets back, they can certainly go big, even though they haven't really needed to go big all that often this season. It's a loaded, loaded team. Marcus Smart is playing super well as the key decision maker a lot of the time. He's averaging almost 8 assists a game, which is, for people like that watched Marcus coming out of Oklahoma State and watched his early career in Boston, him averaging 7.6 assists and 2.2 turnovers, 3-to-1 assist to turnover ratio, playing incredibly effective basketball on the offensive end. I mean, that is it's not remarkable or anything, but it's pretty staggering to some extent. He has turned into the fulcrum of being able to just make high level decisions for this team, initiating the offense. Not to say that Jason and Jaylen don't often initiate the offense, because they do, but Marcus is the guy that's just connecting everybody, keeping it moving, keeping it rolling right along. And yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm spending a lot of time talking about Marcus when at the end of the day, Jason Tatum, I think, would be my pick for MVP in the first quarter of the season. Where do you do tend to get an MVP vote? So you think about these things a lot. Where do you fall on the Jason Tatum and the overall MVP discussion?
It's either him or Curry, I think.
Interesting.
A quarter of the way through the season, I just, like, I mean, if we're saying season ends today, then I get it. The Celtics are the best record in the NBA, and the Warriors are 11 or 11 and 11 or whatever they are. Quarter of the way through the season, I'm just kind of throwing the record aside because I assume the Warriors are not going to end the year 41 and 41. They may not end the year top three in the West, but I don't think they're ending the year 500. I think they will end up with a record good enough to where you won't have to think about it when you're considering Curry, whether Curry is a legitimate MVP candidate or not.
Yeah.
It just stands out to me so much that, like, the reason the Warriors are 11 and 11 has nothing to do with Curry. Their starting lineup is eviscerating teams. Their offense is like literally 26 points per 100 possessions better when he's on the floor. Like, I can't even begin to explain how insane that is to people who don't have some sort of perspective for that already. It's like they're playing 5-on-1 when he's on the floor and 1-on-5 when he's not. Like, it's just insane. It's like if you took all five Warriors when he's not on the floor and doused them in kerosene and then just lit them all on fire, like, you might have the same on offs. Like, it's insanity. And look, you can't penalize Jason Tatum for the fact that everybody in the Celtics bench has been outrageous. And I think every one of their bench players, it feels like every one of their bench players is shooting better than 45 from three. And it's like,
no, right?
I do think that to some degree, their offense is going to come down to some degree because, like, Sam Hauser is making half of his threes. Horford is making half of his threes. Derek White is 45 from three. Grant Williams is making half of his threes. And I sound like I'm using a figure of speech when I say half of his threes, but I actually mean they are literally making half of their threes. And I just struggle to see how, like, four guys on the same team are 50% on a legitimate volume of three, 48 to 50 on a legitimate volume of threes. They play beautiful offense, and if Tatum, he is scoring at will and efficiently, and he has the defensive advantage over Curry, if that's what we're going to talk about here, because he is really important guarding on the wing for them, and he is good in passing lanes, and that's a defense also doesn't really get turnovers at all. So having length and having that guy who can guard well off the ball is, like, exceedingly important. I think he's become an excellent team defender, and that's certainly a major advantage over Curry. And man, just like, it's insane his ability to be able to go get a bucket whenever he wants, and now have the ability, which he's had for a long time, but now have the ability to be able to balance that within what's been the most beautiful offense in the NBA this season. Just an offense that is constantly making the extra pass and constantly finding the corner three-point shooter and constantly saying, okay, this pick and roll didn't work. Let's pull it out and do something again, and then making it work. And it's like the quickest – that offense makes quicker decisions than any other offense in the league. And that really is the reason why it's been the best offense so far. And obviously Tatum is the chief reason for that.
Yeah. It's also just like the versatility of Tatum's offensive game as a scorer. Now he can pull it out and hit you with a pull up step back three to either the right or the left, which is just a ridiculous skill that a lot of guys don't have. He can drive and stop and pop. He has developed a floater game now, which is actually really important for his in-between game. So he's not totally reliant on taking a guy down onto the block and finishing whenever he wants to try and get a mid-range bucket. Oh, by the way, he's stronger now, so he can definitely do that as well. And just in general, I mean, I'm pulling up the numbers now as we talk in terms of his finishing. But yeah, I mean, I was going to say, like, his finishing looks drastically better. And it is. He's shooting 68% at the rim this year. So he's almost an impossible problem to solve as a scorer right now. And on top of that, he plays unselfishly. He takes a couple of bad shots here and there, like any utter superstar does across the league. But everything that Jason Tatum brings to the table as a scorer, as an overall player. Again, you mentioned great off-ball defense. I think he's improved as a passer. There's just a lot here to really, really appreciate with Jason Tatum. I would have Giannis at two, I think, for what it's worth, and I would have Curry at three.
That's fair.
I think that Giannis's overall game this year, I think that, like, for whatever reason, and I know it's like kind of a fucking trope to say it across, you know, basketball at this point, I think we underappreciate Giannis averaging 31, 12, and 6 every night while also being one of the 10 best defenders in the league. Like, he's just so dominant. It's not as aesthetically pleasing as Jason Tatum, but it's just monstrous. That guy is unbelievable to me. We talked about Curry quite a bit.
Yes, he is. I'll tell you what, I saw Giannis in person. I think Giannis is my favorite guy in the league to watch in person. Like, I think there's the greatest disparity between seeing him on TV and seeing him in person, because somebody that big, that strong, that powerful, and just like that relentless, it just doesn't come through all the way on TV. It was why I always said that when I covered him, you know, 5 years ago, that guy, he was Russell Westbrook, was the guy that had that title. It was the same sort of thing. He's just like bigger Russ to me. Giannis's efficiency numbers are down, though. And yeah. I mean, we kind of have to, you know, the only way to separate, I would have Giannis third for what it's worth off the top of my head. But the only way to separate these guys is to nitpick. And Giannis's efficiency numbers are down, though. You could argue he's defensive player of the year right now, because he's been totally and completely outrageous on the defensive end. I think he's as good of a defender as he's ever been. The other thing that I want to add with Tatum, and you touched on it a little bit, I think a really underrated skill in the league these days, because we're so used to seeing threes, we've kind of just all been normalized to seeing threes and been like, okay, well, everybody shoots threes. But look at the Celtics, and it's like literally everybody shoots threes. You know, Grant Williams is a big and he's shooting threes, and Horford is a big and he's shooting threes, and they're making half of their threes. I feel like I need to say throughout this conversation that like everyone on the Celtics is making half of their threes. It's insanity.
I looked up the exact numbers. They have five guys shooting 44%+ from three at like genuine volume, which is the most insane thing I think I've ever seen in my life.
It's insane. But it's like Horford is 48 or 49, and so is Hauser.
Yep.
And I think Derek White is 45 or 46. And it's like, yep. And
Grant Williams is 44. Like, Grant Williams is the fifth best shooter on the Boston Celtics right now at 44% from three. That is insane.
So insane. But anyway, getting back to the Tatum point. So this is good, because this kind of shows, all right, we have normalized 3-point shooting. Grant Williams is the 17th best shooter on the Boston Celtics, and he is shooting 87% from 3-point range, right? And they have a two-way guy who actually somehow broke math, and he's shooting 103% from three. It's like really weird. It's a complicated thing. You have to carry the two. It's really weird, but he's shooting 103% from three. But anyway, underrated skill, because we're so used to seeing threes and we're so used to seeing guys just chuck them up too. There are still so few big wings who are like awesome pull-up 3-point shooters.
Yeah.
It's like Tatum and Kevin Durant, all the awesome pull-up shooters. And we see the value in the pull-up three. We see it with Curry, and we see it with Lillard, and we see it with Darius Garland, and we see it with Zach LaVine.
To me, the best example of this is Luka, because we see how valuable it is with Luka, even though Luka shoots 33% on them, right? Like, Luka is the big wing that you're talking about, essentially, right? Like, he's 6'8". I know he plays point guard, but like, he's this size, right? Even him shooting 33% on them is still incredibly valuable.
Totally. And you know what? Tatum's a better pull-up shooter than Luka.
For sure.
Like, there are things Luka does better than Tatum, and Luka's ability to create space on his step back. Like Luka is as good at creating space when he's going left and then stepping back as any other player in the league. But Tatum's ability to shoot threes specifically off the dribble is as good as any other 6A plus player in the league. You know, the only other guy on his level, I would say, is Durant, unless I'm just forgetting somebody, right? And it's just, it's incredibly rare to be an elite, to be a top-notch pull-up three-point shooter as a big wing. And guys who are guarding Jason Tatum are often just, they're not used to that kind of stuff. And the reason why I note it as like so incredibly valuable is because part of the reason that pull-ups are valuable is because they put the defense into a frenzy. And part of the reason that they put the defense into a frenzy is because they're difficult to contest. They come up quickly, they surprise you, and they're part of kind of general chaos that isn't quite as organized as like a catch and shoot opportunity. And how the hell are you supposed to contest the uncontestable shot from the dude who's even taller than the previously uncontestable shooters? Like, it's just so difficult to alter. You're just not altering Jason Tatum's shot. And I think the ultimate guy in the league like this is Durant, where it's like, I don't care if you have the best player in the league at closing out, flying right into Kevin Durant's face. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah. It literally has to be Giannis. That's the only person. Like only person that can really contest. Yeah.
It just doesn't matter. Like, but Durant, he's not altered by it. Kevin Durant is making or missing the shots. He's not his form, his concentration. Yeah. He is so unbelievably great that he has just broken the way that you defend basketball, that you defend players in basketball. And that's why Kevin Durant shoots 55% from range. It's just, you can't contest Kevin Durant's shot. It doesn't do anything because of the height and because of his concentration. And Durant is the best tall shooter ever, probably. But Jason Tatum is really unbelievable at that now. And his pull-up game, his footwork is extraordinary. So much of this has to do with footwork. The dude has just become so incredibly refined at a size that is extremely rare to see it, even in today's day and age. And I just think we need to appreciate that from a guy like that.
Yeah, and look, like, here's the thing. So comparing Jason Tatum and Kevin Durant in terms of like what they've accomplished is kind of silly, right? Because Kevin Durant is who he is, and, you know, all respect to Kevin Durant on this podcast. I have probably my favorite player to watch, like, in the NBA, point blank. I do think that Jason Tatum gets more separation. I think he has more shit in his bag in terms of like handling the ball. It's just that Kevin, like you said, is the best shooter that is 6'10" or taller in NBA history, and that is an impossible fucking thing to guard. At the end of the day,
he doesn't need to get separation. It doesn't matter. That's my point. Like, my Kevin Durant take is that KD is the least, he's not the best player in NBA history, but he's the least flawed player in NBA history.
Ooh.
His worst trait is excellent. He has fewer flaws, because he has none, than
that's
any
a
other
good
player
question.
In NBA history.
What is his worst trait? Is it like passing and playmaking a little, like vision?
Yeah, like, kind of. But he's a really good passer. So
he's a really good passer. Yeah, but like all this is
that's
on
my
the margins,
point.
Right?
We're like, do this. But like LeBron, like, you could be like, you can't defend LeBron if LeBron is going to go off. But you know how you're supposed to defend LeBron. You don't want him getting to the rim, and you don't want him letting all the three points going off. And LeBron kills because he hit 7 threes that are just like, right, LeBron hit 7 threes. But LeBron is not an 80% free throw shooter, and he is an inconsistent three-point shooter, even though he's a good three-point shooter. He has things that we could reasonably say, okay, that is actually a weakness on the LeBron James scale. And with KD, I don't know, maybe it's like off-ball defense during the regular season. Like, it's just like, you know, and like when he's playing the Detroit Pistons.
Yeah, like, look at what he's doing right now, though. Like, he has that defense, like, on his shoulders, like he's Atlas, like, carrying them right now.
Right. So, well, that's the thing. He has, when he goes hard, like he had 1 year in Golden State where he just decided like, I'm going to go absolutely nuts defensively. And he was like, he blocked like a 1.5 shots a game or 1.7 shots a game that year. And he was just insane as a weak side defender. And he was obviously so good in those small lineups that they ran out and everything. And like, he is capable of being an excellent defender. I'm just like, this is my point. So he is the least flawed player in NBA history.
I think I like that point. Just to finish MVP, the other guys that I would have in the mix here, I think you have to put Devin Booker in the mix. Chris Paul, this is the last time we will invoke the name Chris Paul on this podcast, even in spite of recent news events. Chris Paul is not having his best season in his career. DeAndre Ayton has taken a bit of a step back defensively. Mikal Bridges has been great, but like I would say Mikal Bridges has been their second best player. And Devin Booker is carrying the Phoenix Suns right now to the best record in the Western Conference, even in spite of that. So I would have Devin Booker in my top five. I would have Kevin Durant in my top five right now for MVP. I know that they're 12 and 11. Yeah.
100%.
But he's averaging 37 and 5 and is shooting approximately 1,000,000,000% from mid-range. I would have those guys ahead of Luka at this point. I know what Luka is doing, but it feels like Dallas is still struggling to calibrate everything around him to optimize him in a pretty real way. And I still can't quite figure out if that offense is actually working like to its highest level. The defense is certainly not working to the level they need it to. That team needs that defense to be, a top 10 defense given the resources that they've put in. But it feels like with the addition of Christian Wood, they're still trying to integrate him defensively. Luka, I think, has gotten even a little bit worse defensively just because of the immense load that he's carrying offensively without Jalen Brunson. It's hard. I would have Luka at 6 probably, but I would have Booker and Durant at 4 and 5.
Yeah, I think Dallas is going to turn it around. I mean, not like turn it around, vault to the Western Conference Finals again, but like their role players.
They're a bummer to watch, man.
I know, but Reggie Bullock is going to start making his threes, and Tim Hardaway Jr. is going to start making his threes, and things will look a lot differently when they're in the mid-30s from three than when they're like 28 like they are now. Like Tim Hardaway Jr., I think, has been the least – I mean, he's made like 11 threes in his last two games, I think. But until a couple of games ago, he was the least efficient high volume player, like, or not even high volume, but just with like any reasonable amount of volume player in the NBA this year. And Bullock is shooting 20 some odd percent from three and gets off to a slow start every single year. And I don't know why, but it happens every year. And then he turns it on in the second half. So I think when their role players start hitting threes, Kleba hasn't shot well from three either. When their role players start hitting threes, I think they're going to look a lot better offensively. I also think I just anticipate they're going to make a trade. I think they're going to trade for another ball handler. I don't know who it's going to be, but I think they're going to trade for somebody. You keep hearing about that. Everyone in the league is speculating on them trading for a guard.
Let's transition to the New York Knicks because they're a team that has a few ball handlers that have been in the news recently in regard to trade rumors. But let's take a quick commercial break before we get there. Let's talk about a different kind of performance than what we're talking about with the NCAA tournament. They want to help your performance in the bedroom. Joy Mode, just like on the basketball court, sometimes you might have an off night. Maybe you're playing okay and you want to take your game up a level even. That's where Joy Mode is going to come in. Don't grab some over-the-counter pills that you see at a gas station. They're going to often contain unregulated chemicals, suggest unsafe doses, carry the risk of several other health problems down the road. That's why we've partnered with Joy Mode. Whether you're looking to spice up your intimate moments or increase your confidence in the bedroom, Joy Mode makes all natural and science-backed supplements dedicated to helping men perform better across their core functions. Their trademark product, the Sexual Performance Booster, is every man's solution for increased performance. It's like a pre-workout, but for sex. And get this, all ingredients have been assessed in peer-reviewed journals and researched in humans. Imagine this, it comes in a palm-sized packet, like your favorite electrolyte powder. Just simply mix it with 6 to 8 ounces of water 45 minutes before sexual activity begins, and you're going to watch the magic unfold. Redefine your intimacy and go to use joymode.com for 20% off with code GAMETHEORY. That's GAMETHEORY. That's 20% off and free shipping with code GAMETHEORY. Not only is this the only supplement you'll need in the bedroom, but it also supports blood vessel support, cardiovascular and heart health, athletic performance, blood pressure, and general erection function. So why settle for anything less? Whether you're happy or unhappy with your performance in the bedroom, why not perform even better with Joy Mode? Okay, we're back. And we're going to the team that Fred Katz covers full time for The Athletic, the New York Knicks. Fred, the Knicks are the weirdest team in the NBA to me, to be honest. Like, you look around the league, and I think that they are the only team that either does not just have a superstar and is like full scale competing, or does not have like a guy that you can point to as being like a future superstar, right? Like even like De'Aaron Fox and Sabonis and those guys, like I think that you can with the Kings, and the Kings are so fun, right? That you can point to those guys as like, we're building around those guys, like for sure. They are the number one and number two option. Like that's it, right? Or you can look at someone like Orlando, who's 5-17 right now. They have Paulo. Charlotte has LaMelo Ball. Detroit has Cade Cunningham. Houston has Jalen Green. Maybe San Antonio is probably the other one. San Antonio probably stands out. But
what about Chicago? Is that disrespectful to Zach LaVine?
Well, I think it might be DeMar, disrespectful to DeMar. But
I mean, DeMar was second team All-NBA last year. That's true.
Yeah.
I agree.
So, like,
It'd probably be San Antonio, but they have a real direction.
So, like, the Knicks just don't have a – I don't want to say they don't have a direction. I think they are trying to accomplish something, I'm sure. I just can't pinpoint what it is. And
that is one hell of a lukewarm statement. I'm sure – put that, you know what, there's like the Knicks Twitter joke of hang the banner whenever something reasonably like good not exciting happens. That should be the slogan in front of MSG. I'm sure they're trying to accomplish something, I'm sure.
So the way I want to frame this discussion is I want to talk about like what they're doing, and then want to talk about what the goal is, like what their long-term trajectory is. So I don't know. Do you want to go first, or do you want me to like give a take first on like where I am on them?
I want to hear the San Vicini take.
Fred, and you're muted.
I'll follow you.
There we go. Okay. There we go.
I want the San Vicini take.
Okay. So they're playing a little bit younger, it feels like, over the course of the last like couple of weeks, which is interesting to me. It feels like they just have decided to play the kids a little bit more. Grimes is starting now that he's back. Quickly is like in this weird position where it feels like he's kind of in the rotation, kind of just at the back end of the rotation. He's really the one young guy where like it feels strange right now in terms of what they're trying to do with him. Actually, a lot of them, it feels weird because like Obi Toppin is taking over half of his shots from behind the 3-point line, which is just like an absolutely fucking crazy thing that I can't understand at all. You have this incredible, unbelievable leaper, and you're like, oh yeah, let's not run him in pick and rolls to the basket constantly. I get that they have Jericho Sims and Mitchell Robinson that they have to keep around the basket constantly. And, you know, Isaiah Hartenstein is going to be your short roll guy, but like playing Obi Toppin and Hartenstein, where you have Hartenstein out high and then you have Toppin roll into the basket, maybe in some Spain pick and roll actions. I think that that could actually get pretty interesting. But it doesn't feel like they have that creativity. And yet, they're pretty good on offense. like, they're actually a good offensive team in terms of the way it bears itself out with the numbers. It's just like they're winning on offense by crashing the offensive glass and not turning the ball over. Basically, they're winning the possession game. And I don't actually know how sustainable that is to building anything. Like, they're not winning based off of skill. They're winning based off of just like getting more bites at the apple than other teams. And I don't know how much that's actually like building towards something right now. So let's start there.
Yeah. I mean, they're also scoring based on shot selection too. Like they're taking fewer long twos than any other team in the NBA right now.
Yeah.
One thing that I kind of noticed over the offseason with how they put together their personnel, and then I really saw it at the start of the preseason and ended up writing something on it, was how many guys who just love floaters that they have put together on this team.
I have this note too. Yeah.
I think they have put together a roster in which, and that was not a, that was a conscious decision, by the way. And in reporting out that story that I wrote about floaters, I learned like they had in internal numbers saying that Mitchell Robinson was unbelievable at offensive rebounding floaters. And they also believed that Tibbs, I have a quote in that story from Tibbs saying that floaters are the new mid-range shot, where you step in, you have a little bit of a higher foul rate. It's when you can't get all the way to the rim, but you have a little bit of a higher foul. You have a higher foul rate on it than you do on mid-range shots because you have momentum going to the rim. And it also, you have a higher offensive rebound rate on it because it forces a big man defender to still, with the threat of the floater, force the big man defender to step up, and then you don't have a rebounder on there and somebody can wreak havoc. I was able actually to get my hands on the Mitchell Robinson stat that was alluded to me, and I was able to recover it. And Mitchell Robinson by himself last season had a higher offensive rebound rate on floaters than seven other NBA teams, like total. So like Mitchell Robinson out by himself out rebounded 7 5-man like units, you know, an unbelievable accomplishment like that. He was by far the best offensive rebounder on floaters. And if you look at the way that he rebounds, you know, he's a positive rebounder, right? Where he just jumps over dudes as opposed to a negative offensive rebounder like Steven Adams, who just carves people out. And that's the type of rebound you're going to thrive on those sorts of shots. And the reason that I bring this up, even though it's very niche and very specific, is because I think it gets to a point that you were touching on before where you say, like, is this sustainable or is this really building something? And I think there are different levels of building something. I think there is putting together a team that you believe the players on it are able to take you to the next level. But I think there is also putting together a culture that is able to find interesting little kind of marginal ways to make the guys who were on your team for the long term better. And I think the Knicks have in some ways veered totally in the wrong direction on that. For example, Julius Randle is best when he's inside the 3-point arc, but RJ Barrett is best when he's inside the 3-point arc, but Jalen Brunson is best when he's inside the 3-point arc, but Mitchell Robinson might actually spend more time with at least 1 foot in the paint while he's on the floor than any other team, any other player in the entire NBA.
Maybe team.
He doesn't. 15. Because hey, if he's out rebounding teams, he might as well be out paint standing teams. Not just because he is, he's only going to score there, but also because offensively they weaponize him as an offensive rebounder. That's where they keep him. That's a lot of his offensive value. And yet those four guys, they all have in their starting lineup and it looks really clunky sometimes. But then there are other ways where I'm like, okay, well, that's a like the rebounding stuff with building around Mitch's offensive rebounding, where he is, and I mean, I think there's an argument to be made he's the best offensive rebounder in the game next to Steven Adams. I think Adams is definitely the best, but I think Mitch might be number two, and that's something that you might want to factor in when you've signed him for four more years. So there's like a weird back and forth there where I don't think it's necessarily all good, but I don't think it's necessarily all bad either. I think the greater issue is kind of what you touched on at first, which is just like, okay, what's the future and what's the direction? Yeah. You want to trade for the first superstar in the door. I believe there are a lot of flaws to that, because you trade for the first superstar in the door, you give up a superstar package, it's going to be really hard to have enough left in the cupboard to go out and actually build around that superstar and accomplish what that superstar is going to want you to accomplish, which is to win a title. So I think it's a flawed plan. And that to me is the greatest kind of thing that's hanging over the team right now. Otherwise, I think they're just kind of like, I think they'll probably end up somewhere in the play-in range, and they have some good players, and Jalen Brunson is, I think, been better than anybody could have expected, or at least as good as anyone could have expected. The other question is, what the heck is going to go on? Hey, I want your take on RJ Barrett. You're like the ultimate developmental guy. Like, first, I want your take on this RJ Barrett season.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you said previously, and then we'll talk about Barrett.
Yeah,
because I think you're right in terms of it being a flawed process in terms of the way they're going about it. And the reason for that is that you have all of these players that like to operate in the same spots on the court, right? Jalen Brunson, Julius Randle, RJ Barrett, Mitchell Robinson, Obi Toppin, X, Y, and Z, right? They all love that either they love the 14 foot and in range, right? Like, that is where they are most effective. So the older players, the leaders on the team, the guys that are a little bit more developed, they are naturally going to take those opportunities away from the younger guys. And I think that you're seeing that in the way that they are developing Emmanuel Quickley and Obi Toppin. And look, I've never been like the highest person in the world on Quickley. I still think like he's probably a sixth man, if we're being completely honest with it. But there's just like not really a lot of space for him to develop, frankly. Like, Obi Toppin, again, I don't know how you have this player who at Dayton, you drafted based off of his time at Dayton, and you have him basically like sit in the corner. Like, I think that almost a third of his shots so far, maybe like a little bit over a quarter of his shots so far, are corner threes, where he's just like kind of standing around. Like, that's not his game. His game is running up and down the court and running in ball screens and doing things like that. And ultimately the problem with this is you're diminishing the asset value of the players that you have taken in the first round that you're then hoping to go out and trade for a superstar, right? You're hoping to package Emmanuel Quickley, Obi Toppin, maybe Cam Reddish, Quentin Grimes, et cetera. And Grimes will shoot. I'm not worried about that. Like, he's cut off to a shitty shooting start, whatever, right? Missed a lot of the opening part of the season. He'll be back. I think that he's a little bit different just because he was hurt at the start of the year. But I think that they're not... If their goal is to go out and trade for a superstar, they're not actualizing and they're not accelerating the development of the pieces that they're planning to go out and trade for the superstar. Like, at this point, if they want to go out and trade for a superstar, they're giving up an entire like set of draft picks. Like, they're going to have to give up four draft picks, because unless a team really loves RJ Barrett, and I do want to talk about RJ next, like, no one here is a centerpiece for a superstar package, period. That just is what it is.
Yeah, totally.
That's just like a flaw. It's a flaw in the design at the end of the day.
Yes, it is. And I you mentioned Obi Toppin. He's kind of the personification of it all, I think. Where people rest a lot of the blame on Tibbs, in that, you know, you draft a guy number 8 and it's year 3 for him and he's shown that he can do good stuff and he doesn't play. People rest the blame on Tibbs, and I don't think that's the right way to look at it. I really don't. Because Obi came out last, so Obi's rookie year, he really struggled. He was really struggling to just acclimate to NBA games. And it's funny to watch him now, because I always say his greatest trait is his ability to make decisions quickly on the offensive end. And it's funny to watch like games from his rookie season when he looked like his processing speed was like, he looked like a deer in the headlights at times. And now he's just like, okay, got it. Okay. Dribble handoff, go. Or okay, nothing's going on, I'm going to cut. Or okay, nothing's going on, I'm going to screen. And like, he is the movement guy. He is the guy who creates all of this motion, or I shouldn't say all of this motion, but the little motion they have often comes, or at least starts, with Obi Toppin. And, it's funny to see how like he started, but he progresses really at the end of his rookie year. And then coming into year 2, he really shows like, okay, he's not much of a 3-point shooter. He's not creating much for himself off the dribble, but like when he is out there, he changes the pace of the game. He's active. He's a screen setter. He struggles defensively, no question. Struggles as a team defender. He struggles with like his flexibility defensively, like hip flexibility and all that kind of stuff. But like, he plays so hard. He is incredible in transition. He's few off-ball forwards, so he's actually able to change the pace of a game when he's in it, which is a pretty freaking rare thing. We see guards who change the pace of the game all the time, or ball handlers who change the pace of the game all the time, but not like off-ball streaking forwards who are just so incredibly dangerous when they leak out that they're horrifying on a fast break. And he changes the pace of the Knicks offense within the half court as well. And we just saw good stuff happen, and the on-offs reflected that. The Knicks were way better when he was on the floor. And at the end of the year, Julius Randle misses time. Obi steps into the starting lineup and is dropping like 20 a night. The jump shot comes. Yeah, and the jump shot comes too. And the Knicks front office watched all of that happen, watched Obi play 17 minutes last year in spite of that. And I understood last year why people thought it was a Tibbs thing, but they watched all of that happen. And then they went through the offseason and they held on to Julius Randle. They signed Mitchell Robinson to a 4-year contract. They signed Isaiah Hartenstein to a 2-year, $16 million contract. They converted Jericho Sims. And it's like, they could have said, okay, we saw this. We drafted the number 8. They might have said, sorry, my headphone's falling out. They might have said, we don't know what Obi is. Don't know if this is what he did at the end of the year. Who knows? April and end of March numbers on team that aren't in the playoffs are so freaking hard to evaluate. I don't know if this is real. They might have believed that. But that's why you have to carve out some kind of opportunity, because the question, the answer doesn't have to be, oh, he's for real, this is it, so give him time. It has to be, the answer has to be, I know the answer. You have to know when a guy comes number 8 into your organization, you have to know by the time he is extension eligible just what he is. You can't say, or at least you have to think that you know. You can't get to extension eligibility and say, oh, shucks, I don't know. I don't really know what he's worth. I don't know if he's a third big. Maybe. Maybe he's a starting big. And if he is a starting big, I don't really know what the right situation is. And maybe he's not a third big. Maybe he can't be a third big. Maybe he's only a third big on this type of team. I don't know. Can he play backup 5? Probably not. But I can't bet my life on it. I don't know. It's like, you gotta know what you have. And they have not given themselves an opportunity to know.
A good example of this is another back end of the top 10 pick that we're seeing with Utah right now, and Lauri Markkanen. The Bulls didn't know. And part of that was that Lowry got hurt. Part of it was that Jim Boylan was going to develop this bench, part of it was, you know, just a number of different factors that made it hard. But because they didn't know, they allowed him to go in free agency. And he goes to Cleveland, plays in that weirdo three big lineup, and then moves as a, you know, one of the many pieces they moved in a Donovan Mitchell trade. So you got
to
know.
There's another side, Sam, to not knowing, too. There's another side to not knowing. You could be so afraid of getting Markkanen that you could pay a guy, I don't know, you could pay a guy $15 million a year, and then it turns out he is a third big. And now you're paying $15 million a year to a third big. So you just have to know. When you're in a situation where you are not going to win a title, and you're not even going to win a playoff series, like you're not even on the fringe, like your best case scenario is play in tournament and maybe sneak in as the 7 or 8 seed. That is your best case scenario. You have to walk away from that season. If you're going to try to win, you at least, I'm not like one of those people who's like, tear it down and you have to tank. Like, I don't believe that. These are competitive people who work in the NBA, and I understand that competitive people, like, being competitive is not a thing you can just turn off. There are some people who can't just do that, and I respect that and I understand it. But you can't come away from a season like that still not knowing everything you possibly can about what's on your roster. And that, to me, is the bigger thing. Like, turning it over to the young guys, I mean, that's not even really tanking. Like, pulling Evan Fournier from the rotation wasn't tanking because he's older than Quentin Grimes. Quentin Grimes is helping them win basketball games. And
no, it was actually like a smart
what
move.
Quentin Grimes is. Yeah. And you're finding out what Quentin Grimes is. It's not about tanking. It's about having as much information as you can possibly get so you can make the most informed decision on your own personnel.
So let's go to RJ now. I just kind of think that RJ starts years slowly and is going to pick it up now. Like, his last five games, he's averaging, what are the numbers I pulled? 22-6-3 on 46-39-83. Look, I don't know if he's that this year, but I think that the way they've played over the last few games, where they have gone a little bit younger, they've played tight games with the Blazers, the Grizzlies, and the Bucks. I know that they lost three of those five games, but they blew out the Pistons, and I thought they played really well in that Oklahoma City game last Monday. Like, I'm not that worried about RJ at this point. Are you?
I'm a little worried.
Okay. Yeah. Tell me why.
I am. I mean, you're right.
Part of it too is like, part of it too is like, I think they start off slow. He starts off slow, and this team clearly just is still almost in like throw shit at the wall phase. And he is someone that does need like a specific set of players around him to actualize his skills. Like, he's never been just like a guy that you plunk down in the middle and profit, right? You need to surround him with guys like Jalen Brunson. I think Brunson's a really good addition, but like, having Julius Randle there, having Mitchell Robinson there, tying him to those two very often in his minutes on the court, it's not a situation where you're accenting his skills. You're actually making it a little bit harder on him. So I want to see what he looks like in a situation that looks different than this, I guess. But I understand your concern, and I would like to hear why you're a little bit worried.
Yeah. I'm worried because of the decision-making. You know, the efficiency to me is symptomatic of the decision-making. It's there are still too many moments where he is going to the rim and he's really strong and he's really good at getting to the paint, but there are still too many moments where he's going to the rim and he's got 2 feet in the paint and he's got his man in front of him and two guys have helped from the wing onto him because teams are just like, whatever, throw everything at RJ. He's probably just going to shoot it. And then he does. And he's got fill the blank teammate wide open on the wing. I find he's okay at finding guys in the corner. If you help from the corner, he might find the corner 3-point shooter. But if you help from the wing, he never really finds the guy on the wing. And I know that is something like decision making on drives and kind of making those sorts of passes that are just like the proper next pass is something that he worked on a lot over the summer. And I don't think I've really seen enough progression from him in that, is at least as much as I kind of expected, because I know he's a hard worker. And I know he cares. I know he cares about playing team basketball. And to me, it's not an unselfish thing. It's an unaware thing. And I was expecting him to come out and be better at that kind of stuff. And I think once he is better at that kind of stuff, you're going to see it in his efficiency, because you're not going to see those shots out of the triple teams. But man, there was a play in Denver like 2 weeks ago. Or when was Denver? 3 weeks ago. And it's the final of the second quarter. And there's Barrett dribbles it down the floor. And three Knicks stay in the backcourt because there's like 5 seconds left on the clock. And four Nuggets run with RJ down the court. And RJ maneuvers on the left side of the court inside the 3-point line. Four Nuggets around him. Emmanuel quickly decided to run down the court. And Emmanuel quickly is on the opposite corner, jumping up and down, arms flailing. Could have ordered a pizza and eaten at least three slices by the time RJ found him and the defense recovered. And RJ shot a fall away 17 footer to end the quarter out of the triple. And it's those kind of passes where I was, or those kinds of plays where I'm like, you just gotta find those. And by the way, we haven't talked about their defense, which is really, that's the issue.
Oh, it's horrible. Like it's horrible.
They're 26 in points allowed per possession. They are one of the worst defensive rebounding teams in the league. I actually think RJ has been one of the problems. The reason I bring this up is because I think he's been, I don't think he's been as good guarding the ball this year, but I also think he's been one of the problems as a defensive rebounder. He had a game against Portland the other, like, I guess 2 weeks ago, and Josh Hart had 6 offensive rebounds in that game. I go back and I watch every Josh Hart offensive rebound from that game. And on 3 or 4 of them, it's like RJ is on him and Josh Hart just kind of jogs right by RJ for offensive rebounds. Like, he's just not blocking out. And the reason I mentioned that is not because it was exceptional. It's because I've just seen that sort of stuff from him this year.
And the reason it's important is because that has always been a big selling point with RJ, is that he is going to do the little things like rebound. He is going to play hard defensively. He, over the course of his second and third years, I thought was a pretty good on-ball defender, to be honest. This year, I do think he's taking a step back. I think in general, the team is struggling to contain dribble penetration. That goes to Jalen Brunson as well. It goes to Quickly when he's in the game, I think struggles with it. I think that RJ struggles with it this year for whatever reason. And is it maybe like, you know, RJ's minute totals are finally down into the like more semi-manageable 34 minute per game mark, but still, like, you would think that, you know, maybe it is like just 4 years of playing a billion minutes per game and like leading the league in minutes. Like, maybe he's adjusting mentally, where it's like, okay, I know what I have to do to get through a full season now. And like, there are minutes where I have to like slow down defensively on some level. Like, I can't go full bore for 3,000 minutes a season because Nick Tibbs doesn't take me out of the game. Like, I don't know, man. I agree with you. His defense has been disappointing. It honestly has been like, I'm not worried about it long term because I think he'll defend when it matters. Like, I think he's proven now that he'll defend when it matters. But if I was a Knicks fan watching the Knicks night in, night out, I would be very disappointed with RJ's defense for sure.
Yeah. And I think like, look, he's not the problem for them defensively. He's one of many. I mean, yeah. I just bring it up because we're talking about him. They have a lot of issues. I don't even think he's their. It's not like he's their most detrimental defender. Julius Randle's been their most detrimental defender this year. But
yeah, and here's the thing: they're 25th in defense, it could be worse. Like, statistically, it could be worse. Teams are shooting. They've given up the fifth most three-pointers above the break. Overall, they give up the third most wide-open three-pointers per game. Again, I think that comes mostly from not being able to contain ball handlers off the dribble, and then teams just spraying kickouts. Teams are only shooting like 33.9% on them on above the break threes. Like, this could be worse than it is right now defensively. And to me, it's personnel, but like, that's where I start to wonder, is this like the early symptom of Tom Thibodeau wearing out his welcome a little bit?
Maybe. I mean, I don't think, when I watch them, I don't think they don't play hard. You know, Randall aside, defensively.
I was going to say. Yeah.
But that's one person, you know? I don't think you can watch one person when the rest, like Quickly plays hard defensively. Like, yeah, I don't think does. RJ is like not a
just
not
small.
Hard.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think RJ is like a not hard playing player. Like, Jalen Brunson gets killed sometimes defensively, but he plays very hard defensively. He's just my height, you know, like he's just
super
small.
Quick. Yeah,
right. Totally. He has physical limitations. Like, it doesn't matter how hard I play or how well I personally am coached. If I were guarding an NBA point guard, I would not be good. But I might play really hard. You know, Brunson just has physical limitations. RJ, I think, has not been as good, no question. But I wouldn't say that like RJ doesn't play hard. I think he just hasn't been as good this year. Like, Reddish has had a reputation for not playing hard in his career, but I think he's totally, I haven't watched Cam Reddish this year and thought there's an effort problem at all. He might rotate to the wrong place. He might fall asleep off the ball. He might get confused times.
Yeah.
I think he's actually been way more disciplined than he was last year in Atlanta and last year in New York defensively. I think he's been much better, but I haven't really watched Cam Reddish and thought, oh, you know, there's a play hard issue. Robinson, I haven't really seen a play hard issue. Hartenstein, like, it's really one guy. And I don't think you can, when it's been one guy for a little bit and that's kind of part of his rep, and it's really just on the defensive end, we're just like, Julius.
Oh, he plays hard when he has a shot at the ball.
Right, he just lingers. Like, it's really pick and rolls that are the biggest problem. It's really pick and rolls. If I were going to play him, I would just put him on the ball all the time, no matter what, because it's how you're going to get the best effort. Just like put him on the best ball handler, no matter what, even though it's just not your best defensive lineup, at least you're not going to have him guarding the back end of pick and roll. Just have him guard Trae Young and see what happens.
I still think that'd be a bad idea.
Of course it would be a bad idea. I'm being tongue in cheek, but it's just like, there are so many times now, like, other teams are noticing it and they are like, I don't even want to say they are picking at the wound when they notice that they are just killing him in pick and rolls. Like,
they're not picking at the wound when the wound already has gangrene showing from the outside.
Yeah, they are taking like a machete and they're just slicing what was the wound. Like, it's, they're just going at it again and again, and that's hurt them too. They've struggled against like basically every kind of screen. They've gotten killed on certain guys running off of pin downs throughout the year. They've gotten killed on just like general screen communication, like weird moments where guys aren't running the coverages that at least on the outside, I believe they're supposed to be running. Guys botch switches or botch certain coverages. A lot of this is, you know, Randall is a common denominator on a lot of it, but I will give him credit. Julius Randall has been so much better offensively this year than he was last year. And it's another reason why their offense is a lot better than you would expect. Julius Randall, to his credit, spent all of last year standing around jab stepping and shooting long twos, right? And then over the offseason, very consciously said, I am not doing that anymore, and is playing much faster, is making much better decisions, and is just like not shooting long twos anymore. And I didn't expect that to happen. And I think he's been about as good as you could have hoped offensively as well. And him and Brunson being as good as you could have hoped offensively is a big reason also why they've outplayed offensive expectations.
Yeah. Okay. We got to finish on the Knicks because I have one more topic I want to hit here with you that I've promised the people. So we're going to go for 5 more minutes.
Let's do it.
Karl Towns is now out for about a month. Let's say it's being positioned as 4 to 6 weeks, month and a half. That'd be the Minnesota Timberwolves have been, I would say, the most disappointing team in the league this year. I know that they went through that little run where they won 5 straight games. You know, they beat the Cavs. Then they got the win in Orlando. They got the win against the 76ers where Joel Embiid was playing, but he was really the only guy among their starters, like the big starters that were playing in that game. They got the win against the Heat. And they got the win against the Pacers. And then, you know, lose to the Hornets, lose to the Warriors, lose to the Wizards. They've lost a game to the Knicks this year. They've lost a game to the Spurs. They've lost 2 to the Spurs. That's right. Like, the overall strength of schedule stuff that's going on with the Timberwolves is very concerning. And on top of it, now they don't have Towns. And if you look at the numbers, they've actually been drastically worse when Rudy Gobert is out on the court alone, as opposed to like both Rudy Gobert and Karl Towns, or just Karl Towns on the court. So this feels concerning to me. It also feels concerning to me that they don't really have a roster that is like totally optimized to be able to get the most out of Rudy Gobert, because Anthony Edwards is not like a drive and kick guy that's going to create open threes. D'Angelo Russell just doesn't have the ability to separate at a super high level in the same way that, like, say, a Donovan Mitchell did, driving and kicking and creating open threes that way. Kyle Anderson is just a low volume 3-point shooter. Jaden McDaniels, as good as he is not a guy that I think teams really care about him shooting from three at this point. So I just don't think that this roster is optimized for a lone Rudy Gobert lineup to be out there. And I worry that this thing could go downhill. I know they beat the Grizzlies on Wednesday, and like, I know that there's still a chance here that they could figure this out, but I think it's going to involve a lot of playing Edwards super heavy minutes, a lot of playing Gobert super heavy minutes, and you're losing all this time to try and figure out the Rudy Gobert, Karl Towns situation. It feels like a difficult needle for them to thread now the rest of the way.
Yeah, I'll tell you what concerns me about them the most. And, man, I made this point to someone earlier this week, and I can't remember if I said it on a podcast or in a conversation with someone. So if I said it on a podcast, I haven't listened to that podcast. Sorry, I have to hear it again. The thing that concerns me with them, the reason, like the main reasons they went out and traded all that stuff for Rudy Gobert, is because last year they had 2 huge problems. That number one was that they had to come up with a really kind of gimmicky, blitzy pick and roll defense because they didn't have good enough rim protection. And Rudy Gobert obviously solves that basically on his own. And number two was they were really bad as a defensive rebounding team. And Rudy Gobert was going to save that. One of the reasons lost the Memphis series was because Memphis was just flying. Like, Brandon Clark was just destroying them on the offensive boards for Memphis. And Rudy Gobert is good enough to where it's like he's going to solve that all on his own. They're 26th in defensive rebounding. This roster is put together not to be like good at defensive rebounding. If you're going to be good with this type of roster, you have to clean up. And just like we talked about how the Knicks are squeezing a little bit extra out of their offense by winning the possession game, the Wolves are doing the polar opposite. They're getting killed on the defensive boards, and they aren't good at getting offensive boards. So that is just like doubling the problem. They don't create a lot of turnovers on defense, and they turn it over way more than they should on the other end. So they're doubling the problem on that end. It's like you are just giving away possessions. You are like, I don't know. I'm a Jets fan, so I'm used to this. I'm used to watching Mark Sanchez. Like, this This is not a way to win in a possessions laden sport. And it's very concerning to me that the things that Rudy Gobert was supposed to clean up, it's not like, if they were like 15th in defensive rebounding, I'd still be like, that's a problem. If they were like 12th, that's a problem. If you're going to put together this roster, the point is you have to kill at like the size and grit and physicality things. Like that is the point of this roster. The fact that they are one of the five worst defensive rebounding teams in the league, that they're not finishing possessions, and that they are so losing the possession game to such an extreme, like that makes me really concerned, because it's one thing to be 11-11. It's another thing to be 11-11 against a soft schedule. And it's another thing to be 11-11 against a soft schedule and losing in the exact way you are not supposed to. And yeah. I am concerned. I am. Whether even if Towns had not gotten hurt, I would just be concerned. And none of this is even a commentary on the weird ass vibes that are coming out of that place.
Well, and like, here's the thing. So they, according to Basketball Reference, have played the third easiest schedule in the league so far. And they're sitting at 11-11. This is a team that almost more than anything was built to rack up regular season wins by destroying the glass, by being able to bludgeon teams, by being able to kind of control the paint in a substantial way defensively. But like, the other thing that really worries me is that a lot of the tape, like, I think that overall their defensive deficiencies in the regular season are probably slightly overstated. Like, they are still right around league average in defense, even with Karl Towns having to chase guys around. The problem is that, like, some of the tape that's out there of Karl Towns having to chase around fours and, like, having to chase around guys on the perimeter, it's really bad, and it's really, really easy, I think, to scheme as you move up and start playing playoff-level matchups where you have to win in a seven-game series, and teams are genuinely scheming and throwing in different sets, throwing in different little mini looks that they're going to be able to run when you're having to beat a team four times in a week over seven games, or four times in 2 weeks over seven games. So
totally. I mean, look,
I'm worried about,
like,
that.
People talk about his talent's going to be in the stretch fours. To me, that's not the issue. That's not what we've seen. It's how is he against movement fours? And that's really what it is. I don't really care that much about Karl Towns guarding a corner 3-point shooter. What I care is about Karl Towns trying to get around a pin down. You know, we just talked about Obi Toppin, right? Like, that's just like a bench four, but the Knicks are running them off of pin downs. Like, the Knicks are running them around screens. Like, Towns having to guard that kind of stuff, first of all, that's exhausting for a big man. It's like really exhausting. And second, I mean, especially one who has to carry the offensive load that he does. Second of all, that's just not his defensive skill set. Not that he's some elite rim protector, but I would rather have him guarding some sort of standstill corner 3-point shooter than guarding movement guys. And if you can get him onto cutters and curlers and all of that, then you can do some stuff.
Well, and here's the other basic thing, right? So Karl Towns right now is taking 14.4 field goal attempts per game. That is down basically to his rookie year level in terms of shooting volume. Regardless of what you think Anthony Edwards can be in the future, Karl Towns is your best offensive player, and you are reducing his output offensively with what they've tried to do. And part of what they've tried to do is incorporate his passing ability more. And I think that he has probably been unselfish to a fault trying to integrate all of these pieces long term. But man, it just feels like it's so clogged up on offense every single time that I watch them. Like, Karl Towns likes to go down on the block and like likes to try and like bludgeon a guy who's like a mismatch four, right? Or if he gets a guard on him. It's hard to do that when Rudy Gobert is right next to him, because you get that help that's automatically coming over. It just feels like a roster that actually doesn't accentuate their best offensive player's skill set more than anything. Like, you can say that you need a great defender next to Carl Towns, but like, you maybe could have tried to trade 2 first-round picks for Miles Turner this summer, gotten 80% of what Rudy Gobert brings defensively, got the floor spacing maybe, and then tried to make it work that way, right? Instead of giving up a shit ton of assets for Rudy Gobert and taking the ball out of your best player's hands more often, basically. And this isn't necessarily, I don't think that it's Rudy's fault. I just think that it's a byproduct of what's happening with this team so far.
I think that is very well said.
Yeah. Okay. Fred, we got to get you out of here. Tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people what you've got going on. Tell the people you've got coming at The Athletic. Just, I don't know what all you got to say. Go for it.
You can follow my Knicks coverage at The Athletic. You can follow me on Twitter at Fred Katz, and that's it. Follow Sam.
That's it.
He's great.
Go to The Athletic. Keep us employed over there. We have a promotional link, theathletic.com/gametheory. So you can go there and subscribe to The Athletic. That would be very valuable for both Fred and I, especially me. Please go read Fred's Knicks coverage. I will have some other stuff coming up at the website at some point this month. Keep it locked here, though. Until next time, we'll talk soon.